All right. So the game plan was to look at yesterday was this idea of looking at in terms of like what God is trying to do and bring us around into His family. And I hope you left yesterday realizing that the key is that you don't have to do some spectacular, stupendous event. God's not looking for you to provide some great thing that He needs. He's going to do all that for you. All He wants us to do is live like children in His family, to follow the directions of the coach or the director, if you're into drama or things like that, whatever that happens to be. You follow the directions, and He's laid out the game plan, and it's just a matter of doing what He says. And we have to practice His way of life. And we certainly have the angels to look at. We can mimic their behavior, and we can watch how they behave. And so He's given us family members to actually have a look at. I sort of look at the angels as like, if you've ever gone to, in high school, we used to have something in our school where they have an opportunity to do job shadowing. I don't know if you still do that in schools at all. Anybody do that where you get up into 11th grade or 12th grade and they let you like go on the job. You decide you want to be a dentist. So they let you leave school for a day and go sit in a dentist's office and watch what a dentist does. It's a great idea because you get to see, do you really want to do that? Is that something you really want to do? Instead of just being an academic textbook field, you actually get to get out there and find out if that's what you want. I really think that's what God's done with us, with the angels. He's given us job shadowing. You watch what the angels do, and this is what He's offered to us. He's offered to let us join the family in their work. So I think that's what's been offered to us. And really, the key that we have to provide, what was the key thing we have to have from last night? What do we got to have? Faith. We've got to have faith. We've got to have a trust in God. We've got to have that ability to see the unseen. And we have to have that assurance that Paul quotes. It's the assurance, the hope that He's laid up for us. Even though things may happen in your life that you're not sure about, or you wonder about, or you're discouraged about, faith allows you to believe that God really is in control and He really will reward you. He'll bring you into His family if you just follow the game plan. That's not real complicated. It's not like some subject you've got to sit there and study and study and I'll try to figure it all out. It's not complicated at all. It's just difficult to do. Most people don't want to follow the game plan. So the goal in the first class today is to have a look at how this impacts elevating our lives to God's moral code. This is part of what faith will do. Faith will drive us to living a different kind of life. We can't just please ourselves anymore, but now we're going to find out, well, what does really God require of us? I was really interested in looking through the internet for pictures, because I'm always scanning Google images for pictures for classes. I used to teach high school for years. For 6 years, I taught math and then biology for about 20-some years. And I used to use a lot of visuals, because I found out most kids were visual learners. So I threw a lot of pictures up there and got used to it. And when Google Images came out, that was like, whew, that was great. I actually remember those days when we didn't have Google Images when I first started teaching. But I was surprised to find that when I was looking at morality, in terms of like the Bible and morality today, that out on the internet, there's this whole field of people who believe that you can be moral without the Bible. You don't need God. So why believe in God? Just be good for goodness sake. This is their philosophy. And you find this is keyed in with the American Humanist Society, or the Coalition of Reason, some of them say. Or here's one that's what, whybelieveingod.org. And so their philosophy is that you don't need to go to the Bible. You don't need to be religious to be moral. You can just be moral on your own. Some of you may have seen these signs. This is out Sacramento. Sacramento, that's hometown, pretty close to James. Have you ever seen any of these signs out there at all? I've never seen any of them on the freeways, but evidently they're out there. Are you good without God? Well, millions are. You don't really need God to be good. This is their philosophy of life. Or millions of people are good without God. You don't need a religion to be a good moral person. So they're trying to say, you don't need to go to church. You don't need to be religious. You can just be good. Or, you really need religion to convince yourself that murder is wrong or something like that. Now, all of that sounds good from a humanistic framework. It all sounds like, yeah, that would be great. The problem is, it doesn't always hold up. Here's another one on prayer. You want a better world? Well, prayer's not required. You don't have to pray about it. So they're trying to discourage people from looking into the Bible. In fact, a lot of them make fun of it. They just figure, like, if you're depending on the Bible to do this for you, it's like, what's the matter with you? But the problem with all of this stuff, when you start looking at it, is although it sounds great on the surface, what do you do when you get into other topics that this doesn't have an answer for? Because they would sit there and debate, do you pay taxes? Is that good to pay taxes? because now you get into politics and supporting a government. It's the same kind of question that the Jews would ask Jesus, you know, should we pay taxes to Caesar? Or what about divorce and remarriage? You know, is that okay? One person might think it's good, the other person may think it's not good, and what's their basis? You know, a husband and a wife can't even agree in a humanistic philosophy of what's good, what's not good, because they don't, you know, they're arguing from a humanistic perspective, and there's a lot of differences there. You get into gay marriages or premarital sex, nudity and polygamy. What about war? What about war? You know, so it's not good to murder. You know, do you need the Bible to teach you that? But what happens when people come into your country and start killing you? What do you do when that kind of thing happens? Or what about stealing from the rich? Is that okay? Is that morally okay if you have like a good motive behind it because you're going to give to the poor? You know, does that make it good? And so you get into all these questions, slavery, abuse, and all these things. Somebody along the way, when you get into it, has to define what is good. And the nice thing for us is that's been done because we've got the game book, we've got our Bibles in front of us, and we just got to read them and find out what God defines as good. So you get into this moral dilemma of who's going to define the morals? Who's going to do that? Are we going to let the government do that for us? Are you going to let society do that for you? Are you just going to like look in an area? Like imagine going to school, and imagine those of you that go to public high school, imagine what it would be like if you just ask all the kids in the school to come up with what they think are the good rules for the school. Would you want to go to that school? I wouldn't, because I used to see kids do that, tell me like what they thought was going to be good for our school, and their view of good was not one that I thought was going to really help the whole school, because they were just thinking about what they wanted. That's what was good to them, and not really thinking about the implications of everybody else. So that's the problem. Humanism, when you look at it, that all of those philosophies that were up there, they came from this humanistic perspective, and they're all designed for people who live only for this life. They're not looking for the future. They don't care about a kingdom that's coming. They're not trying to please a god. They're just trying to say, for right now, in this world today, what's good to you? And that's how they define good. That's where they get their morals from. And, you know, it's the problem is today, you can get drawn into that as a young person. You can think, oh, maybe this is good. But you've got to look at the whole thing and find out, is that really the package that you want? Because although some of their things may sound good, there's a whole lot of things they really don't have the answers for. Because they feel you only live once. So what you do is you define all of your morals around how you feel now and how you, you know, treat other people, you know, in this life only. That's the way it works. So if you ever look at any of the stuff on humanism, that's what you will find. I know a lot of times Christadelphians give classes on the human, how humanism is sort of like filtering into society today. And it really is, this idea of humanism. And so it can easily filter right into us. The difference with the Bible, young people, is that God's morality has design behind it. It's not just about what makes you feel good now. It's not just about like, you know, how you treat other people now. It's all about a design. He's got this whole game plan figured out, and he's designed it in such a way that he can train you to become part of his family. It's not just piecemeal of, you know, we sit there and we debate, well, what do you think about this? What do I think? We come up with some compromise. That isn't how it works. He's got it all figured out, and he's laid it out for us in our Bibles to teach us how to become part of his family. It's all by design, not just what seems to feel good, look good, or work right now today. It's a whole different situation. And you can trust your coach. This coach was willing to give his son for us. He was willing to put everything out there on the line to try to draw us away from all of this humanistic, human philosophy kind of reasoning and convince us that it's worth trying to join his family because he's offering us something way beyond this life. He's offering you a life that would be so much better to live than the current one that you have today. Imagine joining the angels in their work. Just imagine for a moment being part of a group of people who all go out to work every day, and their goal is to all work together. They don't have any of this selfishness. They don't have any of those things that get in the way today about pride and envy and deceit and all those things. They don't work like that. They're all on the same page. They're all after the same goal, and all they're trying to do is help each other. What a great family to join. That's what he's offered us. That's what he's laid out in front of us if we follow that game plan. It's a great opportunity that we have. So when you look at God's morality, it always has design behind it. It has purpose. when he comes up with a principle that we are supposed to live by, it's because it's going to impact our life in the future. He's training us to join his family. So when he says, don't steal, that's not just because, well, if I steal something from you, that now you don't have it anymore and that's not fair to you. Oh, no. It's because he's trying to teach us that you don't steal because you trust the coach, he's given you what you need, and you don't go after things that he hasn't given you. He has to get us to that point that we trust him. We don't go outside the box and take things he hasn't given us. We don't practice deceit to get it like Jacob did, you know, when he like deceived Esau, his brother. You don't have to live like that because you trust what God is doing is working and he's in control. And so all of his rules are designed along those lines. You look at no other gods before him. That's because he realizes that these other gods, they're not going to teach you the moral principles that you need to be part of his family. That isn't going to work. And so you've got to follow his game plan. It won't work to follow somebody else's. When he says about divorce or adultery, it's not just because it does do violence to the other people. That's true, and he doesn't like that. He hates it when you do that. But what he's trying to get us to do in our families is have an opportunity to practice faithfulness. God holds faithfulness right up on the top of the list of principles. When you look through the Bible, you will see faithfulness to covenants is huge in God's mind. And you see why? Once he gives you immortality and he says, Mark, you've been found faithful and you're going to be given immortality, he can't take it back. He's not ever going to take it back. He has to make sure that Mark is faithful, that he understands faithfulness and that he really wants to live by that before he ever gives any of us immortality. And so in our families today, in your jobs, in everything in this life, he's provided us with an opportunity to every day practice faithfulness. Faithfulness to our ecclesias, our families. When we get married, you know, I made a vow with Aunt Sue about faithfulness. And that's a promise that I made. That's an oath that we take. And God then looks at that and says, well, how do you really feel about those oaths? Are you really going to practice that? Is that really what you're going to do? Are you going to break that oath in this life? And if you can't treat those things seriously in this life, why would he ever give us immortality? We didn't follow the game plan. We're not going along with what he says. And sure, we're going to make some mistakes along the way, and he understands that. But he's expecting us to grow and to learn along the way so that we become more and more faithful people. That's what he really wants. Or you look at things like submission, and a lot of people are bothered by the Bible's view on submission. Why is there so much in the Old Testament about women submitting to men? And even in the New Testament, about women submitting to men, or slaves submitting to their masters. Why is all that in there? Children, submit to your parents. Why does God do that? You know, is it like he has, you know, partiality against people, that he likes guys better than girls? And that bothers some people about the Bible. But that isn't what it's about at all. He's trying to train us in practice. In this life, he's putting us in situations where we learn to practice being submissive. All of us need it. Guys and girls and kids and parents. Everybody needs it. So he provides situations in families where you can practice being submissive. That's good. That's not bad. Because if we can't submit to the mighty hand of God, he can't invite us into his family. And how are you going to submit if you're the kind of person that always has everybody else submit to you? If that's what you want in life. You want everybody else to submit to you. And that's what you like. You like to have that power. He can't invite you into his family because you're going to have to submit to angels. There's going to be angels that are above us in God's kingdom. We're just going to join the family, be incorporated into that family, and we have to fit as a stone fits into a temple. And we're not the best stone. There's other stones more important than us. So he's provided all these things in our lives today. The whole issue of families is by design so that you can practice these principles. This is his morality. This is what he wants us to learn. We don't take vengeance. No vengeance in the Bible. You don't do that. I've noticed that a lot of times you hear about like TV programs today and movies that they make. There's so much stuff in society today about taking vengeance. Something happens and you hear about it in the news. And somebody comes in and they kill people, somebody's family, or somebody has a car accident. And right away, people, they want justice. They want vengeance on the person that did it. And God says, wait a minute, That's not the way my children will be. You don't take vengeance. Why don't we take vengeance? Because we trust God's in control. He's going to take care of it. We don't have to go out there and do it. We don't have to take vengeance on other people because God will do it the right way. That's what he will do. See, this is what solves so many problems in life. You look back in the Old Testament situations at people that were mistreated, and you wonder, like, well, why, you know, why didn't they just go out and take vengeance? Well, that's because they trusted God to do it. They figured God will take care of those things. Imagine how many people, when David committed adultery and then committed murder, and people found out about it, and it sort of like spread out amongst the kingdom. Imagine how many people would have loved to take vengeance, especially if you were part of Uriah's family or something like that. They would have loved to take vengeance. That would be the natural tendency to want vengeance. And you'd think, well, how can God do that? How can he leave David and his king? Look at what he's done. And see, this is where faith allows you to just get out of that feeling, jump out of those shoes, and realize God's in control. He's going to take care of it. And he did. He did it through David's children in a way that none of us could have ever done. He did a much better job than we could ever do of taking care of that issue with David. But this is what faith does. It trusts you. You can see the unseen. God will do it. The angels are out there working every day. They're going to take care of this. I don't need to go take vengeance. And pride. God's trying to knock pride out of us. Pride is one of those human characteristics we all have. We're all born with it. And the angel's job every day, your angel's got to work with you and try to figure out, what can I bring into your life today to help knock out that pride? What can we do in your life to help knock out pride? And so this is what they work on. They custom design events for our life. They bring the right things if we follow the game plan and we trust God so that he can knock vengeance and pride out of us. And we practice submission so that we'll be ready to join his family. And forgiveness and mercy, the two at the bottom down there, if you don't practice them now, how are you ever going to expect to get them from God? Really. It's to me, that is like one of the easiest things to understand in life, and yet it's the hardest for even Christadelphians to apply. It's so against our natural minds. We don't want to forgive. We want some kind of vengeance on people. We want what we call it, justice or whatever. But this is the way we are as people. And God's fighting this in us. He's trying to say, look, don't be like that. Be like God. God, look at our God. Every day we talk to him in prayer, and what do we ask for every day? Forgiveness for our mistakes. We do this every day. Well, why won't we forgive our neighbor? How can we be so hard-hearted to not be willing to extend mercy and forgiveness to other people? It's an unbelievably tough issue for us, and yet on the surface, when you study it, you think it should be so simple. Remember that passage that Jesus quoted, and he said, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. You wonder, like, well, what was that about? I desire mercy and not sacrifice. When you brought a sacrifice to God, when you bring that animal and you kill that animal, right, what are you asking for before God? You bring your animal there. You're doing a sin offering, or you're bringing a burnt offering, or whatever. What are you going to ask for that day when you bring that animal? What are you going to ask? Mercy, forgiveness. Don't give me what I deserve, please. And you walk away from that, and somebody else does something wrong, and you're like, oh, take care of them, right? We want that taken care of. And God says, or Jesus said, I wanted mercy. I wanted you to learn from that. When you were doing those sacrifices, I didn't really want the sacrifice. I wanted you to learn that if you expect mercy, then you better show mercy to other people. If you can't do it for other people and you can't forgive them, how do you ever expect God to forgive you? So the problem is that humanism's morality for all of us today is it's never going to prepare you to join God's family. I really don't think in the end that even the other churches do. You start looking at like the philosophies that you have in other churches and what they let people get away with, in a sense, it really doesn't train you to become part of God's family. Reading the Bible, following the Bible, study the game plan, that's what will get you ready for joining God's family and help you understand. So when we were going through Colossians 3 this morning, when it was being read, you know, if then you were raised with Christ, right? These are people that have joined the ecclesia. They've been baptized. They've been brought into Christ. And he says, look, if that's really what's happened in your life, if you've been raised with Christ, you died with him in baptism, and you came out of the water committed to walk in a new way of life, trusting God, living by faith, wanting to live as one of God's family members. All right? If that's the case, then seek the things which are above. Keep your focus up there, not on the stuff on this earth. Don't get worried about pride and vengeance and all the stuff that people of this life are worried about. Seek the things which are above, where Christ is sitting at his right hand. And set your mind on those things above, not on the things of the earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. And when Christ, who is our life, appears, then you will appear with him in glory. This is God's game plan. This is what the coach is trying to get across to us through the writings of the Apostle Paul. If this is really what you want, then here is what we need to do. This is how the faith and the works work together, like James would say. You know, you set your mind on things that are above. So you're careful about what things you do during the day. You're always looking for help and talking to God in prayer, thinking about the things of the future, not just the things of this life. All right, this is the whole goal, because what's happened is that the angels, when they designed our world with God, I think it was really a joint game plan, they designed our whole world in some kind of a hope. I really think when you start looking at our world today, and you know, we sort of grow up in families, and we just sort of think, well, families are just like random. No, families were by design. And you find that when you're just doing the readings the last few days in Genesis 1, 2, 3. They designed families. I think the angels did that. They took from a man, they took from his side and made a woman, and then had them be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth by design, because they knew that that game plan would help you learn how to live in God's family. Well, when they made our world, it was the same way. We don't just have one son by randomness. You could have more than one sun in your universe. You could easily do that and have planets that were revolving around others. You could have more than one moon, as some of the planets do. You know, but when they designed our world, they gave us our blue sky up there and our sun that arises every morning, right, and the moon at night, to teach us about godly principles, about the fact that, you know, ourselves here, if we're just left on our own on this planet without that sun, we're dead. That sun, every day when it shines on this planet, provides the energy input that we need in order for all the plants to grow, to give us the food that we have so we can survive. This is what keeps our world going. So you look up there into the heavens and realize that there's a source outside this planet, beyond Earth, that's going to bring energy to our world, to bring life. And so that's why Jesus would talk in those ways when he was talking in John's Gospel and talk about walking in the light. And he is the light of the world and all those concepts, because they designed the creation to teach us those things. You just got to look around in our world today and see that the things that they put into practice, all designed to teach us about our God, thankfulness that we should have with him. So as you were going through Colossians chapter 3, did you notice then that there are things that Paul expects us to do? You know, if we set our minds on things above, then we put to death in your members which are on the earth. You put them to death. Fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, covetousness, which is idolatry. Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience, in which you yourselves once walked when you lived in them. Now, isn't that an interesting, honest statement to make? These people used to be like that. This is where they came from. This is human nature at its raw form. This is what people are like without the impact of God's morality. There's things like passion, uncleanness, fornication, evil desire, because to them at that time, that was okay. I mean, for some of the pagans, even those were things, the right things to do. So you look back at that and says, that's what you used to do. But now you've got to put those things off, right? You've got to put off all these things, anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth. Do not lie to one another, since you put off the old man with his deeds and have put on the new man, who is renewed in knowledge according to the image of him who created him. So what God is doing is he's reforming us. He's reshaping us. He's taking what we were naturally, and he's turning us into somebody else. Now, some people will look at that and say, well, that's like brainwashing. Well, in a sense, he is brainwashing us. But in this case, he's allowing you to make the choice about whether or not you want to have your brain washed. Do you want to get rid of all those negative things and replace them with a positive way of life? And he offers us that opportunity. This is what the coach is saying. If you want to, I can change you into somebody different. and then I can invite you into my family if you want. But he's not going to make you do it. It's a choice that you're going to have to make. But what a great thing to live with people who try to follow those things. And that's what God's hoping to do. So what he did then is he designed families. When you grow up in a family, you have a mom and a dad, you have brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles. He designed families to teach us these principles. You know, you think back and realize, well, when they created Adam and Eve, they didn't have to make Adam and then Eve. The angels could have done something different. They could have made five Adams. They could have made three Eves. They could have. They could have just said in such a way that you grow up and it's all going to be a commune. Forget the families. We'll grow up like a community. We'll just all share everything. All right, they could have allowed polygamy back then if they wanted to. They could have just said, well, if you don't like your wife, just divorce her and have somebody else. That's not the way they designed it. It was designed so that God could teach us about how to live in his family. So they looked and said that it's not good for the man to be alone. All right? That they didn't want Adam to be alone. They wanted him to have Eve. They wanted him to have a family and replenish the earth. You go into Genesis 18 when God picks Abraham. Remember what happened? You know, the earth became corrupt again, and God was about ready. You know, I can imagine how frustrating it was to the angels. They had worked with this community. They'd gone through the flood. They changed the languages, and now the whole world becomes corrupt again. What are we going to do? Well, this time they decide, all right, there's one guy here who's faithful. We'll pick him, Abraham, and we'll use him and his family, and we'll grow our family from him. That's what we'll do. And they picked Abraham. They said, look, I've known Abraham, that he might command his children. It's going to have an impact in his family. And so they picked Abraham and his family and regrew God's family on earth through Abraham. That's what they did. So when you get to Ephesians 3 then, when the Apostle Paul is talking about bringing in the Gentiles, that this plan that God had all along, not just to take Abraham's family, but also then to pull in Gentiles and fill the whole family of God and bring those people from this earth and unite them with the angels. That was the plan all along. So he refers to the Father of the Lord Jesus Christ, from whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named. See, that's what God's doing. He's creating a family. And what he does, you know, in his framework of time, is he continually adds to his family. That's what he loves to do. And in this case, all of us from this creation, I really think when you get to Revelation 4 and Revelation 5, what you see around the throne, you got the 24 elders and the four living ones, and all the angels are there, and you find how they're faithful of this creation are invited into the whole family of God. It's just a great vision in Revelation 5 when you see that happening. That's what the book of Revelation offers. It offers to those faithful. It's worth what you're going through. It's just endure to the end, because in the end, you are going to be joined to the family of God. That's what he's always offered. And he shows you visions of it actually happening in the book of Revelation. So what God does then, he allows us to experience his character through our families. It's practice time. So when you grow up in a family then, it what this does to you, you go home and you realize, all right, I can't get all upset at my family anymore. I can't be frustrated that God's put me in the wrong family. I can't argue about all those things, because this is what I need to develop the characteristics to join God's family. He's given me the brothers and the sisters I need. He's given me the mom and the dad that I need. And in Ecclesias, when you expand that out, he's given us the ecclesial members that we need for all of us to develop the characteristics to join his family. It's all by design. This is what faith does to you. You start to believe that God is really active in your life. He really is orchestrating things to train you and develop you to become part of his family. It's a lot of work, but he's willing to do it, and he's got lots of angels he sends out to help him out. So when you go back and look at, when you're doing the readings, and you go through Mark, and you see that, you know, this is what the angels did. From the beginning of the creation, Jesus answers back to them, that God made them male and female, and for this reason a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife. The two shall become one flesh. So they're no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate. See, this was by design. This is a big issue in God's mind. So for the young people, when you're thinking about getting married, those of you that might be, and you're thinking about marriage, and you look at families that break up and marriages that fall apart, you can't go into it thinking that that's an option for you. That's not how this really was supposed to work. God was hoping that when the two joined together, that you would have an opportunity to practice faithfulness for the rest of your lives, learning how to serve one another, that you can practice submission in those families. These are all good things that he wants us to practice. You can learn how to raise children. Raise children. All the things that children do wrong and all the time it takes. 24/7. Those of you that have had kids, where's Paul and Bethany? You're having kids and you find out, like, you know, you start seeing kids in your family and you watch your brothers and sisters go through this. All of a sudden, your whole focus now is on that little baby. You wonder, like, how could this happen? How can our lives just been taken over by this little thing that's only 7 pounds? But it does. It takes over. Yeah, you know that story, right? It just takes over your life. Now, some people look at that and they resist. And they think, well, I don't want that. Because they don't understand. This was God's way of teaching us. This is what he's doing for us every day. Every day the angels are with you 24/7, 365. And they're taking care of us like little kids. They're making sure we don't have accidents on the way home when we're driving through all this snow tomorrow. They're making sure that the right events happen so that they can train us to join their family. This is what angels are willing to do for you all the time. And so God's trying to help us look at life from his perspective by letting you practice it in your own families. It's a great idea. I mean, really, the best way to learn something is to do it. Don't read about it. Go do it. And so they designed our world so we could practice those things. I think the passage in Malachi is really interesting. When you get to the end of the Old Testament there and you're reading through Malachi and you look at why God was so upset with the Jews at this time, well, one of the things he mentions, especially amongst the leaders, that they were just like, they were just deciding, all right, you don't like your wife anymore, you just say, oh, on to the next one. You find another one. You don't like that one after a while, you find another one. And this is what the men were doing at this time. And so God says to them, look, you guys aren't being faithful at all. These were leaders in this case. They'd broken the covenant with Levi. And so in chapter 2, he says to them, did he not make, this was back when he's looking at the creation, he being God there, which is probably all of the Elohim in this case, did he not make one? See, that's one wife for Adam. He made one. And yet he had the residue of the Spirit. It's like, what do you think? When you read back through Genesis 3, and you see that the angels chose to make a woman, a helper for Adam, do you think they ran out of spirit that they couldn't make another one? I mean, it's a bit of a sarcastic statement there, but this is what he's trying to get them to understand. When the angels chose to make one Eve for the one Adam, this was by design. This is what God was trying to do. And why did he do it? He said, look, therefore, take heed to your spirit and let none of you deal treacherously against the wife of your youth. And he goes on in Malachi and he says, why did he do it? Because he's seeking godly seed. He wants the children to grow up with a mom and a dad so they can learn the principles of family life in God's family, and that they will then slide into God's family so much easier than the people that don't have those opportunities. It was all by design to bring people into God's family. It's not by random events that this happened. It's all by the God's design. He knew this was the game plan to help develop God's children. So what we want to do in raising godly children, we need people at home instructing our children. This was part of his plan. The goal in Malachi was to raise godly seed. We need moms that are willing to stay home and raise our children. We need dads that are willing to have jobs so you can stick around and help raise your children and be involved in raising our children. The focus is on children when you get older. And some of you right now, you're just like thinking, oh, this is so far away. Well, if Christ stays away for another 5 years, some of you could be in this situation 5 years from now. You have to think this through before all of a sudden it just happens to you and you're sitting there married to somebody and you've got two kids. And then you're trying to figure it out. What is this all about? Well, this is the time to think through what God's trying to do. So what you do then is with your children, God's trying to train you just like with the angels. He's trying to help you understand this is what he and his angels go through every day. And so he puts us in circumstances where we can practice this in our families. That's really what he wants us to do. I hope we can go home looking at our families a little different. Really, your family is an opportunity for you to practice godliness in your family. That's what he really wants. And I think when you finally get that in your family, then what you can do is extend that to your ecclesia and realize that all God has done is he's designed a religious system, an ecclesial life, where you can take all these family principles, and now, if you've learned to do it in your family, can you now do it in the ecclesia? It's a great design. It really is. He lets you practice in your family. So that, I know, like when Sue and I had our kids, when we were raising our children, our first one comes along, you just love that little baby, you focus on that baby, and you take care of little Stephen, and you raise him. And then there was Paul, and then there's Rebecca, and all these kids come along, and we found it so easy to love our children. And God does that to us. You know, every mom picks up their little baby, and, oh, it's so cute. And I look at other people's babies, and I don't see them near as cute as they do. But they see them as so cute. You know, they just love that little baby. So he's put us in a circumstance where you can learn in your family how it works. This is how he loves you. And then once you realize that this is how it works, what he's hoping is that we will then learn to love other people's children and love other people in the ecclesia, other people in God's family like we love our own. So you have to learn to move those walls out and incorporate the whole family of God. This is the design that he has. So you practice in your family so you can get good at it, and then you take that into the ecclesial family and hope that you can expand it into the ecclesial family. It's an awesome design. I mean, if you try to think of a better way to do it, I've looked at it and figured out, how could you better do this? He's picked the best design. This really does work if you follow the game plan. So when the Apostle Paul writes in 2 Corinthians, you know, about not being, this is out of the RSV, don't be mismated with unbelievers. For what partnership have righteousness with iniquity? Or what fellowship has light with darkness? Or what accord has Christ with Belial? Or what has a believer in common with an unbeliever? He's arguing this case of how can you be joined up? If you understand the design and you realize what God's doing in families, and you realize how this has bigger implications than just, well, I love this person, I want to marry them. This is about training for his family forever. Then we better be careful about who we marry. We better be really careful, because this person's going to have a huge impact on your ability to practice these things to join God's family. This can either make us or break us in terms of the practice. So Paul argues this case, what are we doing wanting to be mismated with unbelievers? We don't want to go looking for marriage partners amongst people who aren't godly. They're not going to help us practice these things. The whole design falls apart when that happens. It doesn't work. Because God had said in verse 18, I'll be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters. It was all about training to be part of God's family. And marriage is a big part of that. God wants you to make it. He wants you to be part of his family. So he wants you to look for a partner who's godly, who's trying to be part of his family as well. And if that's the case, young people, I really think it has huge implications about who you date. If you think about it, and you really are honest with yourself, if your goal is to marry a believer, that's what you want to do, then why would you go looking out there in the pool of people that are unbelievers? Why would we do that? Now, I know it's possible you may find somebody who wants to come into the truth, who becomes interested, so you get them involved with somebody else in your ecclesia, and you help them to learn the truth. But you're really playing with fire if you think that you can like pull this off. You know, God has really rescued some people that I know of in the past who have gotten into this too far. But I'll tell you, Aunt Sue and I could give you a whole list of people who thought this was going to work for them, and they're not with us anymore. They're gone. You don't even know about them because they married outside the truth. Your partners took them away, them and their children, and they're gone. And you don't even know who they are. That's sad, but this is the game plan God has set up. And see, this is where faith comes into play. You either trust God and you're willing to play by the game plan, or you think you know better and you go outside the box, and then you hope that in some way God will rescue you in the end. And he doesn't always do that. Sometimes he does, sometimes he doesn't. So I really think that's something you got to be really careful about. Dating is not a game. I've heard young people, I've given classes before and had young people come up and talk to me afterwards. They think dating is a way to witness. This is the way you witness. We have a Christadelphian book that was written like that. It was called The New Life. The Christadelphian office published it, and the fellow who wrote it brought his wife in from the outside, John Marshall, and he put a whole chapter in there about how dating can be a way to witness. In my life, I have not seen that to be successful with the young people that I know. I just think, and if you just ask around, ask your parents, talk to people from older generations about what happened when people tried this, and you'll find out it was not a successful means for bringing people into the truth. Where is that in the Bible? Where does the Bible ever suggest that you play around with an emotional thing like dating and use that as a mechanism to witness for God? I mean, think about it. Where is that in the Bible? It's not in there. It doesn't fall into God's game plan at all. So what you do is you look, you come to gatherings like this, you go to places, you look for people that are on track, trying for godly principles, who understand how this works, and that's your pool of people that you hope that God will bless you with finding a partner so that you can practice these things and be part of God's family. Now look, I know that when you look at all this stuff, I can present this and make it sound like, oh, it's so simple, here's the game plan, you follow it, and everything works out perfect. Well, any of you that have ever played sports know that when the coach says, time to practice, practice can be rough. I had coaches when I was growing up who like got us in the best shape I've ever been in my life, but boy, to get into that shape, it was tough. I mean, you train, and you train, and you work, and you endure, then you do all those things that Paul then uses when he's talking about our spiritual life. It's training, it's endurance, but you endure because you know in the end it's going to produce, you know, getting in shape in this life. Well, Paul realizes it's going to produce a lot more in the age to come. So when he talked about all those faithful people in Hebrews 11, remember that chapter about all the faithful people? Sometimes you wonder, like, what is he doing with that chapter? What he did is he listed for us all these faithful people who endured through trial. It's not just a list of faithful people. He has a motive. Back in chapter 10, he said, you have need of endurance so that after doing the endurance, you would receive the reward. So then in Hebrews 11, he lists all kinds of people who faithfully endured through rough lives, things that they had to go through. Imagine putting Moses out there and a baby Moses in a basket and then trusting somehow that God was going to take care of that baby. That's endurance. That's faith with endurance for those parents. And then all the decisions that Moses made, how he endured through them to finally bring those people out. That's what Paul was trying to do. Well, he gets to the end of chapter 11, and who's the last faithful person on the list when you get to chapter 12? Have you ever noticed how the list was designed? He lists all those people in chapter 11, and then who does he finish with in chapter 12? Who is the greatest example of faith? Yep, Jesus Christ. You know, I've read that for years, not realizing the design, because we did those chapters, doing the readings one chapter a day. You have to read through the book as a book, and then you see the flow. So when he gets to chapter 12, he starts talking about Jesus. I skipped that verse up there, but if you read to Hebrews 12, verses 1 and 2, yeah, looking unto Jesus, who's the author and finisher. How does that finish? The author and finisher of? Actually, it is of faith. Because if you see that little word R, it's in italics. The translators put it in there because they didn't understand that Jesus Christ was saved by faith. They thought he was a God, a pre-existing God. So they couldn't understand how Paul could say that, looking unto Jesus and what he endured, the author and finisher of faith. He's the one who put out the greatest example of endurance through faith. And when he mentions Jesus, what does he say about him? You can see by the context it's about Christ, because what does he say? All the people in chapter 11, what happened to them? They all died in faith, not having received the promise. But when he gets to chapter 12 and mentions Jesus, what did he get? He is now set down on the right hand of the majesty on high. He received the reward. See, he made it by faith. And so what Paul then does in chapter 12 is says, look at all those people in chapter 11 that went through all those troubles and Jesus Christ, what he endured, right? Consider him in verse 3. Jesus, who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You've not yet resisted the bloodshed and striving against sin. And you, have you forgotten the exhortation which he speaks to you as sons? So he says, look at what Christ went through. He endured all those things because he made it by faith. His faith led to his obedience. And Paul now says, look at, he was there as an example for us. And if that's what God did with his own son, what do you expect him to do with all the rest of his sons and daughters? He's going to put all of us through the ringer. We're all going to have to be trained. And so he goes back and quotes, "My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you're rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and he scourges every son he receives." Now, you notice that the word he uses is chastens. It's not punish. God doesn't punish us. If we're on track, we're walking in his family, he's trying to chasten us. He didn't punish David for his sins. He didn't punish Samson for his sins. Punishment is what God reserves for the wicked. He'll punish them because he has no future for them. But what he does with his children is he disciplines you. That's what that word actually means in the Greek. The word chastening, actually the actual word that's based on is teaching. He's teaching us through this. This is his teaching method. This is the coach. And he's training us through all these events that he brings into his life. And he does that for all of his children. So that in verse 7, if you endure chastening, God deals with you as sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, you are illegitimate and not sons. And furthermore, we've had human fathers who corrected us and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they, that's our human parents, they indeed for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them. But he, God, he chastens us for our profit. He's got your best interests in mind, that we may be partakers of his holiness. He's trying to train us so that we can join us into his family and he can share his holiness with us. And for now, Paul's honest. He says, look, for right now, no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but it's painful. It hurts when God brings things into our life. It hurts. But nevertheless, afterward, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those that have been trained by it. And anybody who's practiced in a sport or drama or music or whatever it is, you know that those days of practicing, they just sort of go on and on, and some of those are painful days. But you also realize that that's what it takes to get the finished product. That's what you got to go through. And so this is why you count the cost. God promises that if you faithfully accept what he does in your life, he promises that if you walk with him, he will join you into his family. There's nobody going to separate you from the love of God except yourself. It's your choice. He's not going to make you do it, but he certainly puts it out there. So what God's trying to do, young people, he's trying to reprogram our minds. Because by nature, what we want to do is he's given us this brain that in your central brainstem there, you always want to satisfy yourself. Our basic brains are designed amongst survival. We want to survive. And so we scheme, we deceive ourselves, and we go through all this stuff. And we're really good at it. We are so good at deceiving ourselves and justifying our decisions. A lot of times we don't even know we're doing it. Somebody else will point it out to you and say, you realize, why did you do that? And you don't even realize sometimes because you've been doing it. We're such good schemers. I think when you read about Jacob in the Bible, you can all identify with him. You scheme, you know, for the birthright. You scheme with everything. You scheme with Laban and you try to like trick Laban. You try to do all these things. And see what God did with a schemer like that? Do you realize what God did with Jacob the schemer? And this is such a great example of like what angels do. If you were the angel in charge of Jacob, you were the angel that he wrestled with, and you were trying to work with this man, and you've got this guy who's always scheming his way through life, thinking he's going to get what he wants his way, what do? You take him out of the land, and you take him over to Uncle Laban, who's a better schemer than him, and you make him face a better schemer. What a great idea to teach him why you don't want to scheme in life. You make him look at it right in the mirror with somebody who's better at it than he is, and then you find out, well, does scheming really work? Does that really get what you want? No, it does make people unhappy with you. You become ineffective in ecclesial life or in your families because you got what you wanted, but everybody else hates you for it. So it was a great strategy the angels use. They get him out of the land, they take him up to Laban, and they make him face a better schemer. This is what God will do. He promises he'll knock these things out of our life if we just trust him. He's trying to reprogram our lives. So we tend to make decisions now, and our pleasures now and our satisfaction. But what God wants to do is he's in it for the long haul. He's trying to chasten us and discipline us and teach us how to be members of his family forever. Now, did you notice in readings that we're doing in Colossians, as well as this one in Corinthians, that this is how we all start out. We start out as these ungodly people. So when Paul wrote to these Corinthians, you read through the letter to the Corinthians, you figure out the Corinthians, they were really pretty rotten. They had a lot of flaws in the Corinthian ecclesias. But he goes on to talk to them and says, like, look in verse 9. Because, well, actually in verse 8 there, he's actually referring to them. No, you yourselves do wrong and cheat, and you do these things to your brethren. This is how they were treating each other in Corinth. They'd come in from as unbelievers from a pagan group, and then now they had been brought into the truth, but they were still living like they were schemers and pagans of this life. So Paul says, don't you know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. The brains are so good at deceiving ourselves. Neither fornicators, idolaters, adulterers, homosexuals, sodomites, nor thieves, covetous, drunkards, revilers, extortioners, none of them will inherit the kingdom of God. God can't invite these people into his family. He can't give them immortality. And he says honestly there, and such were some of you. You were, but you were washed and you were sanctified. You were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus and by the Spirit of our God. And so God is hoping that we'll change our lives. You notice that when Paul makes a list like that, and he makes these big lists, fornicators, idolaters, adulterers, homosexuals, sodomites, our natural tendency is to read that list and we sort of rank those things. We say, well, some of these are worse than others. But you ever find that when Paul writes, he doesn't do that. He just takes all the sins, all the common things that we all do wrong, and he just throws them all into one list and says, all of that's wrong, and those people won't be in God's kingdom. He doesn't rank them like we would tend to do. See, we do that today. We sort of rank the sins, and we think, well, that's worse than this, and this is worse than that. But from God's perspective, they're all sins of this life. They're all things that people do who aren't living by faith, and so he can't give them immortality. I think it's fun to watch because Apollo did that a few times. So look, what our coach expects us to do is he wants us to practice every day. Just like those of you, if you ever join a volleyball team, you get out there and you practice and you go through events where you bump the ball against the wall or wherever it is and you get ready for the game. You learn how to practice these things. And so God's given us mechanisms to practice. He's given us people in our families. He's given us ecclesias that we go to. He puts us into work situations where we go out and we work a job. I really believe the angels probably designed those people in terms of like what job we get, who are around us in that job, because they're trying to improve our game. They're trying to work with us, and they do that through the people that we encounter every day. But you've got to practice. This isn't something that's just going to come naturally because you got baptized. This is something that you have to learn to practice. Now, I like the way, I think this is probably out of the New King James or maybe the NASB up in here. This might be the New King James. They got it right. But when you're reading through John's letters, 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, John writes a lot of times in such extremes, like, you know, he who sins is this, and if you sin, you're that. It like black and white, black and white. But if you check some of the modern versions, you'll see that really in the Greek, it's actually practicing righteousness. It's like you're out there practicing to do it. Now, you may make some mistakes along the way, but this is what you're practicing to do. So he says it in verse 7 of 1 John 3, little children, let no one deceive you. He who practices righteousness is righteous, just as he is righteous. He who sins is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning, and the purpose of the Son of God was manifest, that he might destroy the works of the devil. This is what he's trying to do, is get rid of all this stuff out of our lives. Whoever has been born of God does not sin, for his seed remains in him. He cannot sin because he's been born of God. Now, that's sort of an extreme statement. It's not like you're never going to sin, but you're not going to practice sin because God's Son is in you. His seed is in there. He's working on our minds to restore our minds and rebuild them after the image of his Son. And in this, the children of God and the children of the devil are manifest. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is he who does not love his brother. So this is something you have to practice. You practice righteousness. You do it every day. Now, who does he go on to mention? Who didn't practice righteousness? Goes right back to Genesis 4. Who didn't practice? Cain. And so what he does, he says, look, if you live a life like Cain, where you see other people and you envy them, and you're not working on envy, you're not working to get rid of it, when the opportunity comes, you'll murder your brother. Now, you may not kill them, but you'll do stuff in life where you just, like, you take them out because you're not practicing righteousness. That was the difference with Cain and Abel. Cain didn't practice righteousness on a daily basis. He went through life, living his life, doing all his work, but he's not practicing righteousness. That isn't what he really wanted. And when the opportunity came, he made a huge mistake in this case. And it was because he murdered him, because his works were evil and his brothers were righteous. Abel was practicing righteousness and Cain wasn't. So in our families then, what God's done for us is when you go home, this is something you realize. So mom and dad put rules around the house. They put up restrictions in your life. And we look at that and say, well, I don't want that. Paul says in Ephesians 6, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise. Well, he's the only one there with promise, that your days may be long in the land. It was right in the Ten Commandments. So this commandment came with a promise, that it may be well with you, and that you may live long on the earth. So when you go home and mom and dad have rules, you don't look at those rules anymore and just say, oh, I hate the rules. What you realize is this is opportunity for you to practice submission. God wants you to learn to be submissive. He wants you to learn to live within guidelines. This is what he wants. He's going to provide guidelines, too, that we have to live with. And if we can't live within the guidelines of mom and dad, how are we ever going to live in the guidelines of God? He's going to put real guidelines up in our life about how we live. And so this is an opportunity to practice. That's why he would say, children, obey your parents. And he goes on to fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. So what the dads and moms have to do is realize that when you're doing this and setting the rules and dealing with mistakes and all these different things, you don't want to like turn your kids away, just like the angels don't want you to be turned away by things that they bring in your life. But you bring them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord. You train your children the way you understand God's been training you. This is how it works. When you understand what the angels are doing with you, then you in turn can do the same thing with your own children. You bring them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord. In fact, he goes through the whole list there in Ephesians of submissive, about being submissive, because he's trying to get them to understand submissive is a good trait to have. God's morality for us young people is really designed to make you ready for the future. God's in it for the long haul. He's in it for his game plan is for the future of joining his family. But he promises us that if we follow the game plan, that in the end, you will get the fruit of the Spirit. You will turn into someone who is full of love and joy and peace and long-suffering and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and gentleness and self-control. And against such, there is no law. You're not going to be condemned anymore. There's no law. These are all positive traits that you're going to develop because Christ is working in you. And those who are Christ have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. This is what God's training will produce. But you've got to patiently wait for it. You're not going to get it in one day. You're not going to get it in one week. You're not going to go home and one month from now you've like got it all figured out and you're all trained. This takes years for God to do. And you just patiently work through it. And year after year, month after month, week after week, he slowly works through and retrains our minds if we let him. If we're looking for the training. If you're not looking for it, you won't even see it. Life will go on by and you won't even notice what he tried to do. But when you're looking for it, you'll start to see events in your life and realize, oh, I shouldn't have got so mad about that. That was really something God was trying to do to help me. You know, you're driving down the road and a car pulls out in front of you and they're going so slow. And some of you guys are like, get out of my way. I want to get by this person. You don't realize it. Maybe an angel's done that because they're trying to slow you down to prevent you from getting into some accident in the future. And they're trying to work in your life. You start looking at life in a whole different way about God's in control. I just got to read the signs and quit fighting it all along the way. This is what God does to people over time. But you got to go through it in patience. You go back through the Bible and look at all these Bible characters that God made wait. Wait for years before they got something that they wanted. Abraham and Sarah had to wait until it was impossible for them to have a child before God finally let them have a kid. He did the same thing with Isaac and Rebekah. They waited 20 years to have children and finally had those twins. See, this is faithful people wait on God. They don't always force issues. And when they do force issues, remember what happened with Abraham and Sarah? They decided they wouldn't wait anymore. So what did they do? What did they do? They decided, said, all right, work out a deal. Look, Abraham, Sarah said, you take Hagar and have a child through my slave Hagar, and we'll consider that our child. And that child grew up for years, 14 years or so, before Isaac was born. And then what did God say? Abraham pleaded for Ishmael. And what did God say? No, I picked Isaac. See, when people try to scheme it through their own way, God actually designed that with Abraham and Sarah so that the Jewish race would be able to look back at their forefather Abraham and realize when you try to scheme your way through, it doesn't work. You've got to learn to trust God. And he did that in their very first father. And if you think I'm stretching that, read Romans 9 sometime. That's exactly what Paul does in Romans 9. He said, look, God did it with Abraham and Sarah, and then he did it with Isaac and Rebekah. He did the exact same thing. And with Isaac and Rebekah, instead of giving them one kid 14 years apart, he gave them two born at the same day, twins, and God says, Jacob I've loved, Esau I've hated, and he picked one. This was God's design. These aren't things that are in our Bible by random events. They're all by design. If it wasn't for Paul in Romans 9, I don't think I would have ever noticed that. You look at Job, how Job waited for God. He waited for years to understand what God was doing, or at least from, when you're reading through it, it seems like years, but it may have only been months. But you know, Job had to wait a long time to get resolution for his issues. But finally, God did help him. He sent him Elihu and then spoke to him. We just read that in the readings back in December. Look at David's life. David running away from Saul. David's been anointed king. He's supposed to be the king. And he's running away. He's running away for years. He's running, hiding. He finally leaves the land, goes over to the Philistines. He had to wait for years before God finally brought him in and made him king. And Jacob's the same way. So don't be surprised, young people, if you have to wait. God's got plenty of time. He's very patient. And what he wants you to do through those years of waiting is learn to trust him. Trust him. He will take care of you. He will provide things at the right time, but his timetable a lot of times is very different than ours. And faith is the key. That's the peace that we have to provide. We've got to trust him. Faith allows you to see the unseen and to trust in the things that you don't realize are happening, but you realize God is really doing it. And your faith, what Jesus says is our faith has to be like a little mustard seed. It starts out small. It starts out small right now, but what it will do is it just grows. And it grows. God will water it. He's going to work with you every day. And he's going to develop in the end a large bush in this case that Jesus said is big enough for the birds of the air to nest in and to come. And this is what God will do if you let him do it day by day, week by week, month by month. That's the game plan. So what we want to do this weekend then is that learn to grow that faith. We want to start out. We've got that little mustard seed right now, and we want to work on that faith and let it grow. And hopefully over the course of our lifetime, God will develop us into somebody that he can incorporate into his family. And what a great day that would be when he finally invites us into his family to join those angels forever.